Accusations against Oppenheimer were a reflection of the extremes to which those engaged in the nuclear debate were driven. Oppenheimer himself was not immune to this contagion. In June 1951, he gave an off-the-record speech to the Committee on the Present Danger, of which he was a member, a private group dedicated to lobbying the government to build up its conventional defenses. Speaking without notes, he made the argument for a real defense of Western Europe, one that would leave Europe free, not destroyed, by atomic bombs. "In dealing with the Russians," he concluded, "we are coping with a barbarous, backward people who are hardly loyal to their rulers. Our supreme policy should ultimately be to get rid of this atom stuff as a weapon." As a measure of just how far his thinking had evolved, by 1952, Oppenheimer was heard speculating aloud about the possibility of preventive war, an idea he had abhorred only 3 years earlier. To be sure, he never actually advocated it, but on several occasions he broached its possibility. In January 1952, Oppenheimer had a discussion with the Alsop brothers, and Joe Alsop noted that Oppie's line, to put it bluntly, was something damned close to preventive war. "We can't just sit by while a potential enemy builds up the means of our certain destruction." In February 1953, Oppenheimer gave a talk at the Council on Foreign Relations and was asked if the notion of preventive war had any meaning under present conditions. He replied, "I think it does. The general impression I have is that the United States would physically survive, damaged, but physically survive a war that not only started now, but didn't last too long. That does not mean that I think it is a good idea. I believe that until you have looked the tiger in the eye, you are going to be in the worst of all dangers, which is that you will back into it." By 1952, Oppenheimer was generally fed up with Washington. President Truman had ignored his counsel so often that he now took steps to walk away from the whole business of policymaking. Early in May, he lunched at Washington's Cosmos Club with James Conant and Lee DuBridge. The three friends commiserated and gossiped about their standing in Washington. Afterwards, Conant noted in his diary, "Some of the boys have their acts out for three of us on the GAC of AEC. Claim we have dragged our heels on H-bomb. Dark words about Oppie." In June, frustrated by more than a decade of dealing with a bad business now threatening to become really bad, and aware that there was a movement afoot to remove them from the GAC, all three men submitted their resignations from that advisory committee. Oppenheimer wrote his brother that he now intended to devote himself to physics. "Physics is complicated and wondersome, and much too hard for me except as a spectator. It will have to get easy again one of these days, but perhaps not soon." But it wasn't that easy to walk away from Washington. Even as he resigned from the GAC, the AEC's Gordon Dean persuaded him to remain available as a contract consultant. This automatically extended his top-secret Q clearance for another year. And that was not all. In April, he had agreed to Secretary of State Dean Acheson's request that he sit on a special State Department panel of consultants on disarmament. Serving with him were Vannevar Bush, Dartmouth College President John Sloan Dickey, CIA Deputy Director Alan Dulles, and Joseph Johnson, President of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. As usual, the panel elected him chairman. Acheson also recruited McGeorge Bundy, then a 33-year-old professor of government at Harvard, to serve as the panel's recording secretary. Mac Bundy was the son of Henry Stimson's right-hand man, Harvey Bundy, and he was eager to meet Oppenheimer. Bundy was smart, articulate, and witty. As a junior fellow at Harvard, he had co-authored Stimson's 1948 memoir on active service in peace and war. And as the ghostwriter of Stimson's famous Harper's Magazine essay of February 1947, defending the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the decision to use the atomic bomb, Bundy was already familiar with some of the imponderables associated with nuclear weapons. At their first meeting, Oppenheimer took an instant liking to the precocious young Boston Brahmin. Afterwards, Bundy wrote an uncharacteristically humble note to his new friend, saying, "I find it hard to thank you enough for the patience with which you undertook my education last week. I only hope that somehow I can be useful enough to make it worth your effort." In no time at all, the two men were exchanging handwritten notes to each other addressed as "Dear Robert" and "Dear Mac," in which they discussed everything from the merits of Harvard's physics department to the health of their wives. Bundy thought Robert was marvelous, fascinating, and complicated. Bundy would soon learn that controversy stalked his new friend. In one of their early meetings, Oppenheimer and his fellow panelists agreed that their primary question was the problem of survival, in which the United States and Russia faced a scorpion stalemate, which might or might not involve active war without the use of stings. Oppenheimer knew that Teller and his colleagues were hoping to test an early design for the hydrogen bomb later that autumn.
So he was intrigued when Vannevar Bush suggested that before this threshold was crossed, perhaps Washington and Moscow should agree to a complete ban on the testing of any thermonuclear devices.
Such a treaty would require no inspections, since any violation of the ban would immediately be detected. And without tests, the H-bomb could not be developed into a reliable military weapon. A thermonuclear arms race could be stopped before it began.